I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. On Monday, the Occupy movement organized a day of action and solidarity with incarcerated people, calling it Occupy the Prisons. Between 600 and 700 people gathered at San Quentin State Prison to support a sweeping list of demands for prison reform, including abolishing inhumane conditions and torture, abolishing unjust sentences, including the death penalty, life without the possibility of parole, and three strikes, solidarity with prisoner movements for human rights, and the end of repression of activists, and the development of people, not prisons. Inmates in San Quentin were held in lockdown during the rally. Meanwhile, major changes are in place to address overcrowding in the California prison system. Before 2010, according to the Public Policy Institute of California, prisons in this state were operating at 175% capacity, meaning inmates were living in very crowded conditions, for example, in rows of bunks in a converted gym. The Supreme Court stepped in last year to order the transfer or release of roughly 33,000 prisoners within 2 years. That process is called realignment, and it went into effect in October of 2011. According to the ACLU, the new law mandating realignment shifts housing for lower-level offenders from prison to local jail, and it transfers supervision of designated parolees from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to probation. So today we're talking about the most effective ways to solve prison overcrowding and other problems plaguing the criminal justice system in California and across the country. We'll also question the policy of mass incarceration. Who should be locked up? And what are the alternatives to incarceration? If you build it, do you then have to fill it? Joining us today, we have Rena Palta in studio. She reports on criminal justice for KALW News, and she edits KALW's criminal justice blog, The Informant, where you can find news and analysis on all aspects of California's criminal justice landscape. Hi, Rena.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Terry Thornton. She is Deputy Press Secretary for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Hi, Terry.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Margaret Dooley Samuli is the Criminal Justice and Drug Policy Senior Policy Advocate with the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties. Her work is to be a watchdog for the realignment process. Thanks for joining us, Margaret.
Good morning.
And later in the program, we'll be joined by Isaac Ontiveros. He's with Critical Resistance, and he was at San Quentin on Monday for Occupy the Prisons. We also want to invite our callers, our listeners, to take place in this discussion. What's the best way to solve prison overcrowding? If you work in or around prisons, what do you think of realignment? Are there logistical hurdles? And if you've ever spent time in prison, we'd love to hear from you. How could the prison system change? You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. Or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's start with just a little historical context. I'm wondering how we got to this point in California. According to the ACLU, between 1990 and 2005, the prison population increased by 73%. So it went from about 25,000 inmates in the early 80s to a high of more than 170 in 2008 and is beginning to come down. So, Rena, why don't we start with you and then I'll go to you, Terry. How did we get into this system of such a prison boom? And let me just throw out one more statistics. I believe we had in 1980 we had 13 adult prisons and now we have 33. Is that accurate?
Sounds about right, Terry. We probably
know
that better.
Accurate, yeah.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so we'll start with Rena and then go to you, Terry.
So I would think that nationally, certainly the war on drugs played a large role in increasing the population in prison in the United States. This move towards tougher sentencing, mandatory sentencing. In California, you see a little bit of the same thing. I think most people would point to 1977, the repeal of indeterminate sentencing, as sort of the turning point politically in the state, where voters and politicians kind of pushed things in a more punitive direction, and we started getting longer sentences, tougher sentences, harder. It became harder to get out of prison, and consequently, the population boomed.
And Terry, anything to add to that analysis?
No, I think Rena summed it up very well. Tougher sentencing laws, sometimes at the ballot box. We mustn't forget that voters also at the ballot box would vote in tougher sentencing as well. There was just this overall tough on crime, you know, in that in California, definitely, and across our nation.
And let me go to you, Margaret. The ACLU has said that this is a defining civil rights issue of our time with severe racial justice implications. A higher proportion of African Americans are incarcerated in California today than were blacks in apartheid South Africa. Latinos are now the largest group incarcerated in California state prisons. So to what do you attribute these racial and economic disparities in the criminal justice system, Margaret?
Well, the system is broken in a lot of different ways, and I think all of the folks in this conversation recognize that, and we share a desire to right these wrongs. But what we've seen over the years with penalties getting harsher and with punitive drug war practices and other law enforcement practices is we've seen certain neighborhoods targeted. We've seen at points of discretion within the criminal justice system that people of color and poor people fare worse pretty consistently at every step of the way. And all added together with issues of poverty, this is what we see is a highly disproportionate rate of people of color within all parts of the system. And I think one particularly egregious way that this harms certain communities is with the bail system. 71% of the people in jail in California, now I'm talking about county jails, not the prisons, 71% are there awaiting trial. Many, many, many of them have bail that they cannot afford to pay. So they languish in jails waiting for their day in court because they cannot pay an arbitrary bail amount. And again, the class and race issues here dramatically impact certain groups more than others and get in the way of employment, education, family. So that's just one of the most egregious ways that the system is broken at every step of the way.
And it seems that we, as a society, have a lot of stereotypes about who's in prison. So I'd like to kind of get a snapshot. In the federal system, according to the Sentencing Project, only 1 in 10 federal prisoners is locked up for a violent offense of any kind, and more than half are drug offenders. And federal prosecutions for drug offenses more than doubled between 1984 and 2005. The Federal Bureau of Prisons is seeking a 4.2 increase in its budget for a total budget of $6.9 billion for that federal system. So, Terry and Rena, can you tell us what does the California prison population look like? Let's start with you, Terry.
Well, it's changing right now. In 2010, 47,000 people went to prison and served 90 days or less. And just that in and of itself was wasteful. It was inefficient. It didn't even give the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, you know, you barely assess an inmate and boom, they're out the door again.
And that was largely parole violations?
Parole violations. People, as Margaret pointed out, they languish in jail, and they get credit for time served if they do get sentenced to state prison. And so consequently, between that and the parole violators, we had a great number of people serving very, very short sentences. And this churning of these low-level offenders really exacerbated overcrowding as well. It was very inefficient, and it was something that the state could no longer sustain. Then you couple that with the three-judge court's population reduction order as affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and we have to do something. So rather than a wholesale release, you know, the answer to that was realignment, shifting responsibility, shifting funding to the counties, getting low-level offenders closer to home, closer to services. The thinking is that that will reduce recidivism, it will reduce overcrowding, and reduce corrections costs.
Reduce corrections costs, at least at the state level. I'm wondering what the budgetary impact is going to be on counties. But first, before we get into that, so you just gave us a pretty good definition of realignment. Rena, can you tell us a little bit more about how realignment is working right now?
Sure. Well, I think what you see is that it's working very differently in different places in the state. Each county, we have 58 counties in California, they're very, very different places. And I think that's clear when you look at even the people who are in prison now. Looking at 2009 numbers, which was kind of at the height of overcrowding, you saw that 30% of prison inmates came from Los Angeles County. 65% came from Southern California. That's compared to 11.2% from the Bay Area. So what you're seeing is counties have different, vastly different approaches to criminal justice. And that's kind of reflecting in realignment. So you have San Francisco County that's really, they say, at least trying to put a lot of this, of their new resources from the state into rehabilitation, into more friendly probation officers who are more like social workers. And then you have places like San Mateo County, which are maybe a little more tough on crime, that are looking to funnel some of that money into jail construction. And we see that in other places in the state as well. So it's vastly different depending on where you are in the state.
And what are the implications of that? I mean, they've talked about how notorious the L.A. jail system is for its own overcrowding and problematic conditions. What does it really mean to send people back to the counties? Is it just shuffling the deck from prison to jail?
Well, jails are certainly different than prisons. They're not really set up to house people for 5-10 years. So what you're having is counties adapt to the fact that they can't incarcerate people for that long. And they're kind of still figuring it out. But you have, I believe it was Riverside County, which is just starting to let people out early. And then you have Fresno County, which is just not taking any parole violators. Or you have, you know, there's all kinds of options available to people. There's flash incarceration, you know, 10 days in the county jail. But you're right. I don't know if anyone would prefer to be locked up in jail than prison. So counties are really going to have to figure out how they deal with that.
And Margaret, you're a watchdog for this. So what are you seeing in Southern California?
Well, and just to clarify, the ACLU is looking at this statewide. So we have a team of people that are playing the role of not just monitoring what counties are doing, but working to share best practices and recommendations from the field of corrections and public safety throughout the state, because, you know, this, as Rena just said, this is 58 different approaches to realignment, and the state sort of amazingly didn't include in realignment a standardized data collection or analysis system. So there is no state monitoring of how counties are choosing to implement realignment. They have a lot of discretion, a lot of flexibility. And what we would like to see happen is that best practices spread and that there is better monitoring. And that's, you know, a role that we're playing around the state. What we're seeing, as Rena just said, is a lot of different approaches in different places. But to be, you know, to really boil it down, what we're seeing is that California counties are really at a crossroads here. They are choosing to respond to realignment in general in one of two ways. One is the sort of business as usual counties that are thinking of realignment as that simply about where are they going to put the body that they used to ship off to state prison. And that those counties that are thinking about housing bodies are going down the path of jail expansion, and they are absolutely making the same mistake that the state made in trying to build its way out of prison overcrowding instead of looking at public safety policies to get better results at a more affordable cost. And so that's the other road that some counties are going down, not just thinking about how do we house these bodies, but how do we get better public safety? How do we prevent crime, limit future victims by, you know, holding people accountable and setting them up to succeed and not to fail? And that means to get a job, stable housing, back in school. Those counties that are moving in that direction will not have the same kind of jail overcrowding that the builders will have. But one thing that all counties need to do a better job of is dealing with their pretrial population. We do not have jail overcrowding because of sentenced people. We have jail overcrowding because there are too many people behind bars who cannot afford to pay bail.
And is there any move afoot to change the bail system?
Well, the bail bonds industry in California is very powerful, and this is a life or death issue for them. I think the issue, you know, the way to go at this is what realignment begins to make possible, which is to say that bail is not the only way to be released from jail while you're awaiting trial. Realignment allows, and the ACLU would like to see more of this, so we'd like to see the state go further in allowing counties to develop pretrial alternative programs that are not bail-based. They can include bail, but they don't have to. And what you really want is people being held in jail who are a threat to public safety. You do not want people held in county jail and pay for them to be held in county jail if they are not a threat to public safety, particularly among the pretrial population, because remember, these folks are presumed innocent. You really could have the wrong guy. And if he's not, if based on, you know, a scientifically demonstrated, developed risk assessment, if that person does not appear to pose a threat, then he can be released, continue his job, pay his taxes, and go to show up at trial as he's ordered.
And Terry, for people who haven't been to one of California's prisons or jails, what's it like inside? What are conditions like? I know that your boss, the secretary of CDCR, said, I think it was last week in a speech, that he wished that he could provide more incentives for good behavior behind bars.
And we do have some incentives, and the advantage to reducing overcrowding is that for the first time in many years, in decades actually, we get to focus more on rehabilitation. For instance, at California Institution for Men, they're actually establishing a dorm now where there'll be a college program there for younger offenders, especially these offenders that hit 18 years old when they're in the juvenile system and come to state prison to complete their sentences, rather than just, you know, assigning them to some, you know, level 3 or level 4 yard somewhere around the state. They're going to house them specifically at this one prison so that these inmates can get a college education. We're excited, actually, about, for the first time, we're not grappling under the strain of overcrowding, and we can really focus on getting more rehabilitative programs. We have space to do it. At the height of overcrowding in 2007, we were housing more than 20,000 inmates in double and triple bunks, in gyms and day rooms. At the end of this month, we will have none of those kinds of beds. And it's the first time in decades that we finally have this breathing room where we can focus on other issues like gang management, like our classification system, like other reforms. And it's really kind of an exciting time to really focus on corrections and not just grapple with overcrowding.
And what about prisoner safety? And from what I hear from a lot of inmates, there's just rampant brutality that goes unchecked.
Oh, I wouldn't say that it goes unchecked. Every single incident that happens in a prison is investigated. The department does everything it can do to keep people safe, you know, by prison design, by training by our officers, by how you house inmates, by our classification system. There's a lot that goes into keeping inmates safe. But I tell you what, when you don't have the severe overcrowding that we've been experiencing for over the past few years, housing options are going to be better. We're already looking at our numbers for the rate of violence, and we're encouraged that we're seeing that it's actually going down as overcrowding is going down.
That makes sense. Terry, we only have you on for a couple more minutes. I want to get to two questions. The state passed AB 900 a little while ago, which gave money to build more prisons. Now I understand that money can go to fund new jails at the county level. What is the status of AB 900?
Well, it was meant to increase the number of beds in both jails and prisons. That always was the case. That was passed back in 2007. There are some jail construction projects underway, and a lot of the beds that are being expanded in CDCR are specifically for medical care and mental health care. A California medical facility, in fact, earlier this month, they just opened up a 64-bed inpatient mental health facility.
But is that, I guess that gets back to my question, if we keep on building these prisons and jails, these facilities, don't we necessarily have to keep filling them?
For CDCR, I can only speak for CDCR. The beds that CDCR is expanding are specifically for mental health and medical health. There is still a class action lawsuit about medical health. There's a class action lawsuit about mental health. There's another one for dental health. There's another one for disabled inmates. I mean, the CDCR is under several class action lawsuits, and we're obligated to meet the mandates of those and provide a constitutional level of medical care and mental health care.
And let me get all of you to respond before Terry leaves to kind of a fundamental question that I don't know that we always get to, which is, what is our prison system supposed to do? It was a few years back that the Department of Corrections added rehabilitation back into its name. So what fundamentally do you believe that the prison system is supposed to do? Let's start with Margaret.
This country vastly overuses corrections. We started in the 80s locking up people who we were mad at for more and more people for longer and longer terms. So ultimately, we have too many people in prison for too long. It's costing too much, and it's actually doing more harm than good. The system is broken. What corrections should be focused on is prisons and jails should be reserved for people who pose a serious risk to public safety. There are other more effective and affordable ways to hold people accountable outside of those cells, particularly when it comes to drugs.
And let's get an answer from you as well, Terry.
I agree with Margaret, actually. People expect a lot out of prisons. You know, they expect us to take care of them, you know, rehabilitate them, educate them, get them off of drugs, keep them away from the public. The public really expects inmates to come out of prison better than when they went in. But a lot of the things that drive incarceration are drugs. It's broken homes. It's people failing. You know, I've told people before that, you know, people end up in prison. You know, their families may have failed them. Juvenile systems may have failed them. County systems failed them. Probation systems failed them. The school system failed them. They end up in prison, and yet people expect corrections to fix them. You know, this department does the best it can, and I really, truly believe that as overcrowding is going down, we'll be able to focus more on rehabilitation. And as I said earlier, not just grapple under the strain of overcrowding. But, yeah, people do expect a lot, and we really, I think, as a society, as communities, we need to be looking at the front end and look at sentencing. Earlier in the conversation,
Terry, I'm going to have to cut in on you because we're about to go to a break. That's Terry Thornton. She's Deputy Press Secretary for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about prison reform. We're speaking with Rena Palta, who reports on criminal justice for KLW News. We're also joined by Margaret Dooley Samuele, and she is the Criminal Justice and Drug Policy Senior Policy Advocate with the ACLU in Southern California. This is a good opportunity to invite our listeners to join our conversation. What is the role of incarceration in society? Who should be behind bars and who should not? Have we gone too far with mass incarceration? And can we go back once these facilities have been built and an industry has been created around keeping a large prison population? You can join the conversation at 1-866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What are the legitimate public safety issues here? I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. And we have an email newsletter that's a great way to keep up to date about local public radio as well as the latest developments in non-commercial media. Every week or two, you'll get an email from us with updates on KALW programming and public events as well as the occasional free ticket offer. And it's easy to sign up. Just click on the e-newsletter link at kalw.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about movies. What movie has changed your worldview? We're talking about it a few days before that other awards show, and we'll announce your nominations for the film that most powerfully changed the way you understand the world. It could be a documentary, a feature, a short, or even an animation. What movie pulled you into a reality different from your own? Or maybe transformed the way you thought about something familiar? That's tomorrow. Friday, of course, is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news. And today we're talking about prison overcrowding, prison reform. What are the best solutions to over-incarceration? We're also talking about what's changing in California's prison system. The Occupy movement drew attention to the prison industrial complex this week in a day of action called Occupy the Prisons. That was on Monday. They're calling for an end to inhumane conditions for people behind bars. Meanwhile, the realignment process is underway in California, where low-level offenders are being moved from prisons to county jails. Is that the best way to solve prison overcrowding? You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. We have full bank of lines are full right now, but you can continue to call as you hear somebody hang up with us. Also, if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org, and you can post a comment at our new website, yourcallradio.org. So, Terry, you're still with us, correct? Is Terry still with us? Hi, Terry. So I cut you off a little bit there at the end if you wanted to go ahead and finish your thought.
Yes, it was just one thing that we're hopeful about realignment. I mean, people talked about how counties are really doing things differently, and that was one of the features of realignment, and it gives counties individual flexibility to deal with their offenders because, let's face it, you know, offenders in Los Angeles County are not the same as offenders in Butte County. So I think it's important for counties to have that flexibility. But I heard a story recently about one county that was going to sentence this man to 21 years in prison. Basically, he was a heroin user. He was a war veteran and just had problems with drugs, really. And I don't know if he stole. I can't remember all the details. But they were looking at sentencing him to 21 years. But, of course, they realized because of realignment, you know, he would have to serve that time in county jail because it was all non-serious, non-violent offenses. He ended up getting sentenced only 3 or 4 years. And I'm hopeful that realignment will look at sentencing. CDCR, we just carry out the sentences of the courts. Mm-hmm. And I really feel that there needs to be much more focus on sentencing and who you're sending to prison and for what and for how long. I mean, it was just, to me, unconscionable that you would sentence somebody with a drug problem for 21 years.
And, Margaret, do you want to weigh in on that, the sort of dangers of putting this at the county level and, you know, whether or not that becomes a crapshoot for folks living in those counties?
Well, it absolutely does, but it's been that way, actually. As Terry mentioned, you know, it's up to the court and the district attorneys and plea bargaining to determine what kind of penalty is going to be applied to any particular case. So you see very different sentences coming out of different counties, even prior to realignment. That's certainly going to continue, and, you know, you're going to be, it's just going to be luck of the draw whether you're in a county that's going to allow you to get the health care you need for your drug problem, or you're in a county that's going to decide that it wants to spend its local taxpayer dollars to keep you behind bars for 3 years, 6 years. I mean, there's a lot of flexibility, and we're very concerned about equal protection under the law. And, you know, that's a role that the state should continue to play, is monitoring and facilitating counties and incentivizing counties to implement policies that actually protect public safety and allocate scarce resources wisely.
And that's Margaret Dooley Samuley, who's the Criminal Justice and Drug Policy Senior Policy Advocate with the ACLU in Southern California. Rena Palta is also joining us. She reports on criminal justice for KALW News, and she edits KALW's criminal justice blog, The Informant. We've also been speaking with Terry Thornton. She's Deputy Press Secretary for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Terry, I'll say goodbye to you now. Thank you so much for joining us for the first half of the show.
You're welcome, and I hope we can have further discussions. You're kind of covering a lot of ground in a short amount of time, and so we're hopeful that we'll have more discussions.
Absolutely. We plan to revisit this issue this year, next year, for the near future.
That's great.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to get to callers right now. You can join our conversation about criminal justice reform by calling 1-866-798-TALK. That toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And let's go to Sheila in Berkeley. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Holly. Thank you so much for this program. It is so timely and so important. And the reason I'm calling in is because the Berkeley Gray Panthers in the East Bay is having a meeting this very afternoon. The topic is the path to prison reform. So I'd like to invite your audience to come. It's at 1:30 at the North Berkeley Senior Center in 1901 Hearst Avenue. And we have two speakers. One will be talking a bit about the death penalty initiative that the ACLU has been working so hard to put on the ballot this year. And our second speaker, our featured speaker, is Manuel LaFontaine from All of Us or None. He's a formerly incarcerated person himself, so we're going to get a real look at the inside of prisons and how we can help to reform them.
Well, we'll make sure to put a link to that information and how people can find out about tonight's event.
This afternoon at
1:30. Okay, yeah. We'll still put a link at yourcallradio.org. But let me ask you, Sheila, can you tell us just a little bit about that ballot measure that you're trying to get signatures for? It's the California End the Death Penalty Act?
It's the Death Penalty Repeal Initiative statute that the ACLU has been distributing for I don't know how many months. And from what I can tell from our speaker, Alex Madonick, who's been working on it, they're pretty sure that they're going to have enough signatures to put it on the ballot this year. And that's very exciting news.
That's great. So what does prison reform mean to you and to the Gray Panthers group that you're part of?
Well, that's something that's been on our agenda for a long time. We recognize just how many people are in prisons and jails, not just here in California, but across the country. And personally, I have noted and said this to Manuel, our speaker, that isn't it interesting that at a time when we have so much debt, seems to be the only time when we're finally taking a good look at how badly broken the system has been for such a long time. And frankly, how racist it is, as far as I'm concerned. That's my own personal opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Gray Panthers.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Sheila.
Thank you for this very, very timely program. Once again, KALW is right on everything. Thank you.
Thanks, Sheila. Let's go to Isaac. I believe we've got Isaac Ontiveros from Critical Resistance on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. Wanted to hear about the Occupy the Prisons movement. But can I ask you first, Isaac, how do you think prison reform fits into the fight for social and economic justice? How does it fit into the Occupy movement?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the Occupy movement, but I think that and what we've heard of a lot of our speakers, including, you know, Terry Thornton from the CDCR, say is that there is a deeply woven link between, you know, economic and social inequity and imprisonment. So if we look at people who are sent to prison, people who are locked up, whether it be in jails or whether it be in state prisons, we see that these people come from the same communities that are hit hardest by the loss of jobs, by the closing of schools, by the denial of access to healthcare, so on and so forth. And so I think when we think about, making changes in the prison system, I think we're also talking about making changes in the priorities, as whether that be on the county level or whether that be on the state level, around how are we addressing social and economic crisis? Are we addressing it by making thoroughgoing changes to our economic and social structures, or are we continuing the kind of same failed solutions of putting more and more people in prison for longer and longer amounts of time? And then, as people have noted, overwhelmingly these people are poor people and people of color.
In isolated communities, so that there's a high proportion of people in prison in certain communities, and then other communities are completely able not to have any effect on them. So I wanted to know from you, you know, you're talking to people about this. How do you talk about prison reform when there's so many strong stereotypes about who's in prison and the fact that, you know, they should be there?
Well, I think that that's one of the ways that we've gotten ourselves into this crisis, right, is that you have these different, you know, responding to different social and economic crises throughout the past decades. One of the things that was pounced upon was, you know, by tough-on-crime politicians, was to start to really seize on and continue the use of racial stereotypes of, you know, the you know, you see the war on drugs or the war on gangs, creating these boogeymen, creating these monsters, that was really justifying a lock them up and throw away the key mentality. I think that those things pervade, especially if you have, you know, in California, you know, still one of the largest prison systems, not in just the United States, but in the world. And then obviously the United States being the largest prison system in the history of the planet. I think one of the ways in which you sustain such a massively inhumane thing is to continue these terrible stereotypes about who gets locked up and why. At the same time, and I think this intersects with some of the things that we're seeing around the Occupy movement, is people are kind of tired of these worn stereotypes of the fear-mongering that, you know, not only is this fear-mongering not making people feel safer, it is certainly exacerbating, you know, social and economic ills. And I think people are tired of it and they're kind of seeing through it. And we can base that on any number of, you know, the amounts of people that are coming in the streets around the Occupy movement and who is coming, you know, these kind of different cross sections of society. But then also in, you know, polls and studies where people actually get a chance to say what they think around, you know, reforms to the prison system, for example.
A lot of the people that I talk with feel like they don't understand what the message of the Occupy movement is and that it's often dispersed and incoherent. Does bringing something like reforming the prison system into this conversation dilute the other messages?
I think it actually, and you know what I'm seeing from you know Monday's actions and so on, I think maybe it has the opposite effect. I think what it does is gives an opportunity to take people's real concerns and people's real discontent, right? So you know, we can talk about what are the demands, what are the programs, what are the strategies to move forward to make these changes. I think part of what has come out of the Occupy movement is a large kind of upswell in discontent, saying, you know, average people, whatever you want to call them, kind of saying, I am fed up with the way that our economy works. I am fed up with the way, I'm fed up with social systems. I'm fed up with poverty, so on. I think the reform of imprisonment, or, you know, the strong questioning around imprisonment and the Occupy for Prisons actions that happened earlier this week actually allow the Occupy movement to take steps forward to understand things that could possibly change. So, for example, in California, you know, there are a lot of different organizations that are calling for prison moratorium and jail construction moratorium. I think that taking up that steps allows people to start to make the connections around the discontent that they feel around the economy, but to also say, well, wait a minute, here are ways that we could start to address the economy. What if California what if it stopped its priority on prison spending and put a priority on spending on schools, for example? So I think when people are kind of upswelling around, you know, education cuts and healthcare cuts and so on, I think understanding what's getting cut, what's getting spent on, and then I think folks that have come out for Occupy relating to different community organizations or entire communities or individuals who have been fighting against, say, something like the prison system for over a generation now actually gives a chance for the movement to take steps towards clarity, at least a little bit.
That's Isaac Ontiveros. He's with Critical Resistance, and he was also at the Occupy the Prisons movement at San Quentin on Monday. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about prison reform. We're also talking about mass incarceration and the vast increase in the prison population and in prison spending, both at the federal level and at the state level. That's now being changed by realignment, or that's the goal. We're speaking also with Rena Palta, who reports on criminal justice for KLW News, and Margaret Dooley Samuley, who is the criminal justice and drug policy senior policy advocate with the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial County. She's going to be a watchdog for the realignment process. Let's go to another caller, Manuel LaFontaine. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hi, and you're going to be speaking later today at the Gray Panthers at 1:30, right?
Yes, I will. And I think it's important. I think Isaac Ontiveros covered it well, and people have been raising important issues. And I think it's important with this Occupy stuff, if I may briefly interject that, corporation establishment need to create smoke screens to keep the focus off them, to keep divert the attention from the truth, the real fundamental problems, and ultimately them, because the bottom line for them is profit. So assassinating people's characters, in this case by calling them, labeling us formerly ex-cons, criminals, and you know, and labeling us as such, and it's being captured by their recorders, which mainstream media allows for this false perception of what's really going on.
So, Manuel, let me ask you, give us just a little bit of background on your story. You were formerly incarcerated.
Right. I was formerly incarcerated.
Where?
At the time in the California state system. And when I hear the realignment, when I'm hearing discussion about the real problem society, seldom do you hear about the people inside and how they got there to begin with. Many of us were impacted through schools. The schools did not teach us what we could identify and relate with. So there was no culturally competent curriculum going on in a lot of these inner city schools. So a lot of stuff that many of us who are marginally impacted, who are not included in a lot of these mainstream discussions, we don't see ourselves, our representation in schools. We don't see our representations in television unless we're being tokenized.
So what happened to you? How did you end up incarcerated, Manuel?
Well, I was caught up in this false illusion of power. I was caught up in this male supremacist, white supremacist, wanting to be white, wanting to be strong, wanting to have a lot of power. So I was joining informal organizations in the streets, looking for that power. When I got incarcerated behind, my mistake, I ended up...
What was your mistake?
My mistake was an assault on a false enemy.
This what we call gangs?
I don't like to characterize it as gangs, correct.
Yeah,
because
okay.
It doesn't ever incorporate OPD or local law enforcement or FBI or CIA. It only incorporates groups that are not considered part of the formal economy, while the real gangs profit, the real bankers profit.
And so what was your experience like? How many years did you spend in California prisons, and what was it like there?
Well, I spent 6 years, and I was able to help. I mean, it was hard 6 years. I was able to educate myself. I mean, out of the 6 years since, I spent a little bit less than that. But I was able to educate myself on who I really was, find cure for this violent mentality that I had been able to incorporate through television growing up, through the prison system. Sometimes some of the most corrupt people inside are law enforcement that creates problems to keep us divided, to keep us at each other's throat.
And are the prisons racially segregated?
Of course. Yes, it is. The violence, a lot of the violence, a lot of the segregation, a lot of the problems inside is manifested through by the guards, by law enforcement to keep the attention off them. And it's important for us to recognize that there are people inside. That's a key word that I want to leave everybody. We are people and not the labels they use to criminalize us, to scapegoat us for causing society's fundamental problem. This last event that happened on Monday, Occupy for Prisoners, right, was big on many levels. Maybe CNN didn't cover, maybe Fox didn't cover. But what's important to recognize is that seldom, if ever, are people inside asked or given a space, a platform for them to tell their stories. Now, if you were there present, people that were there present, they got to hear their stories through the amplification of their loved ones, through amplification of those that support them, that visit them. And it's important to recognize that they are in solidarity with all those out here who are struggling because they're the most impacted.
And Manuel, I want to get to a few more callers before this hour is over, but a final question for you. How do you think we should be talking about the prison system, and what is your top priority for reform?
Well, it's important for us, and I got to go back, to look at people as human beings. So these people in prisons is a nice name for cages. Anytime they use detention facility, we have to shift that mainstream dialogue to look at human beings as people that can transform their lives. That way they can transform the bigger system that discriminate against us. So it's important for us to look at human beings as people and look at these cages for what they are, because they lock up one of the most marginalized and vulnerable populations in society. Those are those that are not part of the formal economy. So people are important to be looked at. People inside are important to look at as people. And we can shift that. If they're being incarcerated, you best believe their loved ones are being incarcerated, being impacted. If they're in any community of color, the whole community is more impacted. Even if they're in privileged community, that means that these people have to somehow survive in privileged community. So it's everybody's impacted by someone's incarceration. That's very important for everyone to know who's listening.
And any top priority for reform?
Release people. This whole realignment stuff, it's a gimmick. The realignment discussion coming from someone who's been involved in a lot of discussions with the CCP, the Community Corrections Partnership. It's a gimmick. Now, many of us are trying to hope to impact it by saying, we'll start having an honest discussion. We cannot continue to lock up people. And the reason I keep calling it a gimmick, because this is how I'm going to frame it. I'm going to be very brief. If PETA, People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, were to see and understand, recognize the conditions that they hold people inside, and those people are human beings, there'd be a national outcry. Where's People for Ethical for Treatment of Human Beings around? Because moving from people from large cages to kennels is not rehabilitation. Moving people from big yards that I might be considering humane for what it's worth, and then bringing them to little cells with no access to sunlight, that's torture. So all this whole, when I hear realignment, we have to impacted by attending community meetings, by impact them saying, you know what, we got to start releasing people, and if people that can't be released because they have mental issues, substance abuse issues, then we got to find place to put them treatment. They have treatment for rich people, they have treatment for privileged people, but poor people cannot afford those treatment centers.
Well, Manuel,
we're looking for viable answers.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's Manuel LaFontaine. He is a person who was formerly incarcerated, and he's now an activist with All of Us or None. Thanks, Manuel. Let's go next to Matt in Kensington. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on the program. I was fascinated by the man's comments right before me.
Yeah.
I'm a teacher in the jail system, and another aspect of it that I see is I meet guys who are trying to get an education who didn't get an education in the school system. Remember, it costs $55,000 a year to keep a man in prison for a year. It costs, a really good education might be $10,000 a student year. One of the reasons people turn to crime is to make money. You have to have money in our society, and if you can't get it legally, you'll get it illegally. And I don't know, it's too much to say, but I mean, yeah, you need to talk about San Quentin specifically. There are programs going on there now which are fascinating, which prisons out in other places are asking for volunteers to come and help with.
And San Quentin is atypical in that way. They have a lot more
atypical
programs.
Yes.
Let me ask our guests, Matt, about that question of money. You talked about the economic cost of providing an education versus what we spend on, you know.
I sometimes wonder if there's some group that's trying to generate gammas in this country.
Well, let me ask our guests. Margaret, let me start with you, and we're running out of time here. But Margaret and Rena, who's making money off of California prisons? And we should do another show separately on the privatization of prisons, particularly at the federal level. But Margaret, where's the money going here?
We're spending taxpayer dollars on correctional systems. So that's the buildings. It's the people to guard. It's the health care. And what that means is we're spending $9 billion a year of taxpayer dollars on a prison system that does not have enough money to actually provide much rehabilitation services, education, that kind of thing. That's money that we're not able to spend on education, on health care. And as the caller rightly points out, we're not able to fund, the state is not putting the priority in the community. It's wasting taxpayer dollars on a huge, broken prison system. So, yes, there's absolutely an effort, the ACLU is a part of it, to make better decisions about public safety. We want, everybody wants to be safe. And we've got to invest in the policies that get us public safety that are also cost-effective, because they are. And that way, we can put our money where we say our priorities are.
And ultimately, that is a public safety issue. Rena, we just have about a minute left. Can you give us your thoughts on where the money is going and what the priorities for reform should be at this point?
Right. Well, I think it's important to point out that federal receivership is incredibly expensive. And the people who are making the most money as salaries in the system right now are medical providers, because they've had to pay people a lot to come in and try to reform this medical system. So when we get out of receivership, hopefully the costs will go down, and hopefully those costs will be able to, you know, go into other areas of the budget that have nothing to do with corrections.
And what did you think about Manuel's thoughts or assessment of realignment, that it's a ruse?
I think realignment has a lot of potential. I think there's a tendency on a lot of sides of this debate to kind of boogeyman the other side. And I'm hoping that what this Occupy movement, what the new conversations about criminal justice will do, will be helping people take ownership of this system and saying, this is our criminal justice system. We built it, and we have the capacity to change it.
And that's a good place to leave it there. Clearly, there are more conversations that we need to have around this issue. We've been speaking to Rena Palta, who you just heard. She reports on criminal justice for KALW News and edits KALW's criminal justice blog, The Informant, where you can find news and analysis on all aspects of California's criminal justice world. We were also joined earlier by Terry Thornton, who was Deputy Press Secretary for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And you just also heard from Margaret Dooley Samuele, who's the Criminal Justice and Drug Policy Senior Policy Advocate with the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties. We also heard from Isaac Ontiveros of Critical Resistance. We'll put a link to all of those web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org, and that's where you can continue the conversation. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Thank you for your calls, and I'm so sorry we couldn't get to so many of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, we'll talk about what movie has changed your worldview. A few days before that other award show next Sunday, we want to hear your nominations for the film that most powerfully changed the way you understand the world. Documentaries, features, shorts, or even animation. Which movie pulled you into a reality different from your own? Or maybe transformed the way you thought about something familiar? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.